The Guardian. I always say the word awesome was invented for Antarctica because it really does take your breath away. I mean, the colours are fantastic. The blues, the icebergs are kind of a mauvey, pinky, aqua green colour. It's impossible to describe the colour inside of icebergs. And, you know, the sea is blue, reflected from the sky. And then you have the white ice and the white snow. It's absolutely stunning.
Professor Dame Jane Francis knows Antarctica better than most. She spent much of her time in this icy world camping. Jane assures me that pitching a tent really is the best way to collect specimens for her work. And she should know, having uncovered innumerable plant fossils dating back 100 million to 40 million years. These fossils show that Antarctica was once much warmer than it is today. So warm, in fact, that it was covered in forests.
So if you go to, say, the west coast of Tasmania, which is a big state park, and you walk through those forests, you are really walking through Antarctica millions of years ago.
But it wasn't all work, work, work at the South Pole. Cooking was a real passion of Jane's, and out of odds and sods from the ration tin, she even managed to make ice cream. Ice cream that wouldn't freeze in minus 20 degrees Celsius.
And this was a really great mystery to us, which we contemplated every day. Why on earth couldn't we make ice cream in Antarctica?
This time on Science Weekly, Jane Francis talks us through what it's like to live in Antarctica and how what she's found there forces us all to think about our future on the planet. I'm Ian Sample.
Okay, my name is Professor Dame Jane Francis and I'm Director of the British Antarctic Survey.
Jane, a huge welcome to Science Weekly. You're a paleobotanist. Can you start by laying out for our listeners what a paleobotanist is?
Well, actually, I'm a paleobotanist by research, if you like, but currently at the Antarctic Survey, I'm the director, and so actually doing paleobotany is something I can squeeze in the odd minute or two. So paleobotany is the study of fossil plants, basically, and that has become my expertise. So I trained initially as a geologist, somebody who understands rocks and fossils and the history of the earth and history of life. And then through my research, I gradually more and more focused on ancient environments. And I use fossil plants to understand what environments and climates were like in the past.
Jane has spent much of her career in Antarctica, though, where there are no trees, at least not today. But in the 1940s, early British Antarctic Survey explorers found fossilised wood in the region. And so, nearly 50 years later, Jane boarded a ship to collect her own samples.
And I went there, I think, in 1989 with an expedition organised by the British Antarctic Survey, inviting a group of experts in different things. So I went with an expert in fossil animals, fossil shells, penguins, sharks and shark's teeth, a whole range of sediments, the structures, the tectonics, all sorts of people. And we went down for an expedition to look at these islands off the Antarctic Peninsula. That's the long bit that sticks up towards South America. And very few people had been there before. And we found some amazing things, absolutely amazing things. And so that was the beginning, really, of all my future work on the plants from Antarctica.
What's it like when you finally get off the boat and you're walking around Antarctica?
So that particular expedition was by boat, but normally we have been dropped off by possibly helicopter or small boats, left on an island with all our camp gear. You know, at the beginning of every trip, you stand there and the transport disappears. And then you think, oh my goodness, I'm going to be here for 2 months. And it's really cold and we're remote, you know, we're not going to see anybody for another 2 months. And, you know, how am I going to manage to do this? But actually, you do get acclimatized to the cold quite quickly. And you know, in a few days, you know, being cold just becomes part of it, and it's quite refreshing, actually.
I had no idea you were staying in tents. That sounds tough.
Well, it's the only way you can study the rocks. You have to go where the rocks are. So most field programs in Antarctica, when scientists want to study rocks, when they want to study glaciers or drill through the ice or something, they have to go out to the place where they're going to work. And so they've set up a field camp, and that's where they live. So actually, the stations, which are nice and warm and, you know, where everybody thinks we work, are actually just a stopping off point on the way to your field camp. So mostly we have really good tents. The best tents are called Scott tents because they are just like the ones that Scott used. So they're pyramid tents. They're a pyramid with four sides and they're about 7 foot tall. I can stand up in them in the middle. Two people live in there along the side by side, and if there's two of you, you also cook in your tent as well. But these tents are really cozy. They're generally orange, so when you get inside you live in an orange world, and but they're really cozy inside.
What's it like living down there, spending time down there? Are there particular things you miss when you're there?
Actually, the strange thing is, as I've done more and more trips, I really enjoy the isolation. So when you first get there, I find that for sort of about 3 days, then you're still worrying about, you know, things that have been in the news, what's going on in the world, what's going on at work, all that kind of thing. And then something happens, to me at least, on about day three, when suddenly my world shrinks to that island that I'm working on. And that's it. There's nothing outside. But you are kind of isolated from the rest of the world, and you can just focus on what you're doing. So I've often said, you know, you focus on three things, the rocks, the weather, because that's really important for safety, and then what you're going to have for dinner. That becomes a major highlight of life, because you work hard, burn a lot of calories, just trying to keep warm. And so food and eating food and eating enough food is quite important.
And are you on sort of rations? Are you on pretty grim food, to be frank?
Well, actually, the food in Antarctica varies depending which nation you go into the field with. So a couple of times I've been with the American program, and they have big freezers of meat, so you can take steaks. That wasn't a healthy diet. But the British Antarctic Survey has food boxes, which are quite well balanced, actually. But they're mostly dried things. So breakfast is porridge, which is really good, and dried milk powder made up, and some jam, which is the highlight. And then for lunch, we have like ship's biscuits, army biscuits, sardines, chocolate, Marmite, really important to have Marmite. And then the evening meal is usually some kind of dehydrated meat or dehydrated meals with spaghetti, mashed potato, things like that.
Most researchers head out to Antarctica during the Northern Hemisphere's winter or the Southern Hemisphere's summer. That means Jane spent many a Christmas in an orange tent, and one particular year they went all out on a three-course meal.
I was working in a rocky island with two New Zealand lads, and we were again working on some rocks which had fossil forests in them. And we were there on Christmas Day, and we all liked cooking. So we had things like prunes wrapped in bacon, and we had some lamb kind of satay sauce using peanut butter in the main course. And then it was my job to make the dessert. So I made this fantastic dessert with broken up crackers as a crust with a custardy filling, and I thought I'd make ice cream. So, you know, making ice cream should be easy in Antarctica. So I did that. I mixed up milk powder, put some water in, mixed it all up, and I put some vanilla essence in that we'd been given. And then I sort of stuck it outside the tent, and it sort of expected at minus 20 that it would freeze in about 5 minutes and we would have some ice cream. But it just wouldn't freeze. And, you know, I left that outside for a couple of weeks and it didn't freeze. And this was a really great mystery to us, which we contemplated every day. Why on earth couldn't we make ice cream in Antarctica? And then eventually we discovered that artificial vanilla essence, something like ethylene glycol, it's a relative of antifreeze. And so there was no way our ice cream was going to freeze, especially since I put the whole bottle in to make it tasty.
I love that. That's brilliant. I love it. Science saved the day and worked out why it wasn't working. After the break, we'll be talking to Jane about other mysteries of the Antarctic that she's helped to solve, like why there are fossilised plants in one of the coldest and most barren places on the planet.
Well, it's simply that, you know, if you go to Antarctica today, there's hardly any plants in Antarctica. And yet you can look down and see a piece of rock and there's a fossil leaf in it. I mean, it is quite an amazing, it is a paradox. It's quite amazing to see that.
Stay tuned. We'll be back in a minute.
Today in Focus is a new Guardian podcast that brings you closer to our journalism by getting behind the news every weekday. You'll join me, Anushka Astana, talking to people at the centre of the big stories impacting our world. We'll use personal perspectives and expert analysis to put you at the heart of what matters. Listen to Today in Focus and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you choose to listen.
Welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Before the break, Jane recounted her tales of the Antarctic, from fossilised plants to food rations and Christmas dinner. I want to return to her woody work because it's been really important in shining a light on something called the Antarctic Paradox. The paradox being that there are no trees found on the continent today, but when Jane looks down at the rocks, she sees plant fossils everywhere. This has led Jane and other scientists to conclude that Antarctica wasn't always the cold and barren landscape we see today. Proving this wasn't exactly easy though. Forget the cold, Antarctica is mainly covered in ice, with the rock buried beneath.
Less than 1% is rock. For example, there are very high mountains in Antarctica and the tops stick up above the big thick ice cap. And then around the coast, there are rocks that are exposed on the edge of the continent. And then sort of in the Antarctic Peninsula region, there are islands which have either a small ice cap or have quite a lot of rock visible.
And when you look at the rocks that you find there, what do they tell you about Antarctica's past?
Well, what we're looking at is really the history of Antarctica from about 100 million years ago to, well, I've worked on rocks that are about 2 or 3 million years. So quite a span of time. Now, the most important thing is that 100 million years ago, the Antarctic continent was actually situated over the South Pole. So before that, you know, like all continents and tectonic plates, it had drifted around a bit. But actually, we know that 100 million years ago, the continent came under the South Pole, and that's where it has been ever since. So when we find fossil plants, it tells us that Antarctica actually was covered by forests. The kind of plants that we find in Antarctica, on the peninsula particularly, are really just the ancient ancestors of the forests that now live in New Zealand and Tasmania and South America. So if you go to, say, the west coast of Tasmania, which is a big state park, and you walk through those forests, you are really walking through Antarctica millions of years ago. In the same beds of rocks that I can find wood, fossil wood, leaves, and evidence of warmth, we also find a lot of penguin bones. So penguins evolved actually in Antarctica when the climate was warm and there were no major ice sheets.
Which is really strange because we think of them as being incredibly well adapted to the cold, behaviourally, physiologically, you name it.
Exactly. So actually, that's not the case at all. So the penguins must have lived on the land in burrows, like just like they do today. So a lot of penguins live today. You know, they live in the Galapagos, they live in South Africa, they live in Australia. And they live in burrows, they live in the Falklands, they live islands, you know, they live in burrows. And I think that's how they probably lived in Antarctica millions of years ago. And probably just a few species remained in Antarctica as it got cold and have adapted to this very strange environment.
Scientists think that around 40 million years ago, Antarctica changed and became cooler.
And that's when, in the rock record, we see the first evidence of really big ice sheets on Antarctica. So that's when something happened in the climate and the carbon dioxide levels dropped and the big ice sheets grew in Antarctica. But there were still some plants there, and I have worked on rock sequences quite close to the South Pole where we find fossil plants that are just a few million years old. And then after that, then the climate became very cold and sort of life was extinct on Antarctica, and the ice sheets really spread to the edge of the continent.
And this was presumably then, as you were saying, some shift in carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere that caused that change in global temperatures, or what?
So the current thinking is, there's lots of people still working on this, but the current thinking is that there's sort of natural cycles of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that over time the carbon dioxide gets taken back into the rocks and buried, and that cools the climate down. And then several other things happened as well. Before the cooling, Antarctica was joined to South America still. It was kind of a land bridge across there. And that prevented the ocean currents from flowing all around Antarctica. So the ocean currents came from the equator, brought warmth down to Antarctica, and then flowed back up to the equator. But at a certain time, there was a bit of tectonic movement, and the Antarctic Peninsula split from South America. And then for the first time, ocean waters could flow all the way around Antarctica to form the Circumantarctic Current. And that really then isolated Antarctica in this icy tomb of cold water. And that, and low CO2, and there may be some link to mountain building episodes as well, but all joined together to really make an environment in which the big ice sheets on Antarctica started to grow.
This type of climate change involved a complex web of factors over long periods of time, things like ocean currents and atmospheric carbon dioxide. But the climate change we're seeing today is very different. It's driven by us, and it's fast.
Well, no, millions of years ago, obviously, no humans around, and so any changes in carbon dioxide were part of the natural cycle of carbon coming out of volcanoes and then being taken down again into the rock sequence. And although that's cyclical, it's quite a long timescale. I mean, the changes these days are extremely rapid. And what we've done as humans, we've interrupted that natural carbon cycle by putting CO2 into the atmosphere at a much, much faster rate by burning fossil fuels.
When you look at Antarctica, what do you think the implications of that could be of climate change in that region?
Well, the main things that nearly every scientist who works in Antarctica is looking for is evidence of climate change and how the climate is changing. Because the one thing is, when the climate changes, both now and actually in the geological past, the areas on Earth which are most sensitive to change are the polar regions. So the Arctic and the Antarctic, you know, are the places to go and work now to see where the change is happening. First signs of change and the fastest change. So the interesting thing really is that global warming currently is being caused mostly by, you know, the highly populated areas where we're burning a lot of fossil fuels. It's affecting the polar regions first and foremost and most intensely. And then in return, what's happening in the polar regions is affecting the rest of the world. So, you know, Antarctica is just a signal, if you like, of what's going to happen to the whole global system.
Do you have a sense of how quickly we might see some of these dramatic impacts in the polar regions?
Well, actually, you can actually see it happening today. So, for example, the British Antarctic Survey does have a research station in the Arctic, in Svalbard. And I was there this summer, and I've been there in the past, and I was quite horrified, actually, to see how much the glaciers have retreated. I mean, the fjords used to be covered in ice winter and summer, and now hardly any ice forms at all. Well, no ice in the summer and a lot less ice in the winter. So you can actually see things changing. You can see plants growing bigger on the tundra. And then also we can see that the permafrost, you know, the frozen ground up there, is melting, because in the research village where we have our station, some of the buildings are actually now falling into the ground. You know, they're actually being made unstable by the melting permafrost, which is a real problem.
So as a researcher who spent so many years in these different places, how does that make you feel?
Well, as a researcher, it's really interesting to see these changes, actually. You know, this is what we've come to study. But actually, it's quite scary as a person who's living through this age of change, because the change is happening now. I mean, it's really is visible and it is happening. It's not just something that's theoretical that might happen in the future. We can see it happening in the polar regions. And so I think we are going to feel it more and more in the rest of the world very soon.
And in some ways, we're already feeling it. The global sea level has risen on average by 3 millimetres per year since 1993. Predicting how much it will rise in the future is difficult because of the complexity of the Earth and all the systems involved in our climate system. The best estimates come from the International Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC. In a 2013 report, they stated that in a worst-case scenario, sea levels could rise by 90 centimetres before the end of the century.
Certainly, you know, with carbon dioxide levels at 406 parts per million today, something like that. I mean, we haven't seen carbon dioxide levels that high for about 2, 3, 4 million years. And what we see about 3, 4 million years ago is a world which there is still ice on the world. There's still ice on Antarctica, not so much in the Arctic. But we also see that the ice in Antarctica comes and goes quite quickly. It's a very dynamic kind of world. And at times, geologists think that the sea levels were about 20 metres higher than they are today. And then they drop, but then they get 20 metres sea level rise again. So a much more variable world.
Do you think we have any chance of adapting to that kind of change in the environment?
Well, all the current IPCC reports tell us, you know, that we've got to be very careful about what we're doing. You know, we've really got to stop burning coal and we've really got to stop burning fossil fuels if we want the CO2 levels to stabilise and to keep the world as it is. I think we're in a position, though, where we've already got about 400 parts per million. We've already got, even if we stop putting more CO2 in the atmosphere today, we've got decades, maybe 100 years, while the Earth sort of really becomes stabilised at that level. So I think we're going to see some of the ice sheets melt a little bit more and sea levels rise a little bit more. And I think we really have to adapt to what's coming. But we really need to also try and ensure that we're in charge of what's happening and bring down CO2 levels.
Dame Jane Francis, thank you so much for joining us on Science Weekly.
It was a pleasure.
If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can. Our email is scienceweekly@theguardian.com, or you can tweet us at Guardian Audio. Science Weekly was presented by me, Ian Sample, and produced by Greya Jackson. Thanks for listening, Merry Christmas, and I'll see you next time.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.